This is 40ANM N5, a download of 40ANM LLC, recorded at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on Saturday, February 1st, 2014. I'm Chris Bohm, and this is our weekly selection of tech sector and related global news and policy highlights from the past week. Coming up, government data released on U.S. gross domestic product growth shows the economy recovery continues, with officials keeping close eye on the jobless rate and impacts of government cuts. The U.S. Justice Department announces a deal to increase the transparency of surveillance measures ordered of tech companies. What does it mean? Google announces last week the sale of Motorola Mobility to Chinese computer maker Lenovo. With the rise of Bitcoin, some are aiming to curb the misuse of virtual currency while enabling its utility and continued innovation. The Information Law Group does an excellent story on how financial services firms have reacted in the wake of the Target data breach in December. Are there reasons to be optimistic for immigration reform in the U.S. this year? And in the midst of so much privacy-related news occupying the new year, whatever happened to ECPA reform? And finally, tech items of note from President Obama's State of the Union message last Tuesday. But first, according to U.S. government data on the gross domestic product released last Thursday morning, the U.S. economy grew at a healthy 3.2% in the close of 2013. Consumer spending was key to this growth, as data also showed that spending picked up by 3.3%, despite misgivings about the quality of this past season's holiday buying. Exports also increased in the fourth quarter by 11.4%, roughly three times the level of growth in quarter three. But also a key driver of GDP results was spending on services, namely travel and food services. In a release, White House Chief Economist Jason Furman noted that the actual rate of growth in 2013, despite the fourth quarter increase, was roughly only half that amount. But this is primarily due to a steep cut in federal spending last year, as reported by the Washington Post. Federal spending in the fourth quarter alone dropped 12.6%. The hope is, though, that bipartisan deals averting threats of another government shutdown and a budget deal will help to decrease the impact of budget cuts and related uncertainty in 2014. The economic news comes as Janet Yellen officially took the reins of the Federal Reserve as of Saturday of this week, and the Fed has pledged to continue to scale back its bond buying program, noting on Wednesday of the past week that purchasing of bonds will be reduced from $75 billion in January to roughly $65 billion by the close of February. These continuing moves are largely seen as an indication that the Fed is confident in present signs of economic growth, even if the signs are at times a little less than stellar. As economists commented on January 30th to a Washington Post story on the GDP growth, continued growth is in part going to be predicated on job and income growth, and officials will be watching home sales and applications for jobless benefits very closely. As the Post reported, a slowdown in pending home sales was reported in December. However, this is traditional, a slowdown in sales in the winter season. The next Federal Reserve Open Market Committee meeting is scheduled for March 18th through 19th, and Janet Yellen is expected to report to Congress, giving her first Fed chair's traditional biannual message on the state of monetary policy to the Senate Banking Committee on Tuesday, February 11th. According to a deal announced on Wednesday by the U.S. Justice Department, technology and communications companies will be permitted to publish the aggregate data relating to any orders issued pursuant to the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, and in more ways than had been previously reported. While the agreement is a victory for U.S. tech companies who have filed suit to force greater transparency around surveillance requests, particularly Google, Yahoo, Facebook, Microsoft, and LinkedIn, the agreement reached with the Justice Department does have several limitations. For instance, if a company decides that it wants to publish all actions by individual type, such as FISA orders or national security letters, it would have to do so according to bands of numbers as required by justice. In other words, bundled in groups of 1,000. But if the company decides to report these and other action types in single batches, it can do so in groupings of 250. The government reportedly agreed to the deal in exchange for the companies dropping a lawsuit related to the prior disclosure restrictions, and the FISA court must still approve the agreement's terms. The agreement also comes as several tech companies, including Google, have signaled that they appreciated the president's recommendations for reform, while adding that there was more to be done. Speaking to the BBC's Adam Blenford, Google's chief legal officer David Drummond called the president's remarks on January 17th a first step, adding that it's not the final word on where this will go, hopefully, and we intend to be very engaged in that debate. We're concerned, he said, about the long-term user trust in the Internet and what that means for acceptance of new innovations. Mr. Drummond also told the BBC that people really need to trust the Internet and the companies that underpin much of this innovation. The statement of the Justice Department, released on behalf of Attorney General Eric Holder and Director of National Intelligence James Clapper, stated that the agreement on transparency was part of the directions by the President made in his January 17th speech on intelligence reforms, and that the Office of the Director of National Intelligence, in consultation with other departments and agencies, determined that the public interest in disclosing this information now outweighed the national security concerns that had previously required its classification. The Justice Department's statement also affirmed that more work remains on other issues, as in the weeks ahead, additional steps must be taken in order to fully implement the reforms directed by the President. As I said in an interview this past week with Mark Clayton of the Christian Science Monitor, the agreement between Justice and these companies is a first step, but a very important one. For the companies that have been impacted by the data orders, it shows that they are both pushing back, defending what they see as the rights of the customer, and now getting some concessions to increase transparency. And I think that is very helpful for the brand and business of these firms. EU Justice Commissioner Viviane Reding told the BBC that after 2 years of negotiations with the US over European efforts to update legal safeguards for EU citizens and companies exchanging data with the US, she believed that politicians in Washington were beginning to hear the message, adding that President Obama would meet with European Commission head José Manuel Barroso on March 26th. In what came as a somewhat shock last week, Google announced that it was selling Motorola Mobility to Chinese computer maker Lenovo. The $2.9 billion deal will make Lenovo the world's third largest smartphone manufacturer, with Samsung and Apple in the top spots. Google had paid roughly $12.5 billion for Motorola about 2 years ago and intends to keep much of Motorola's patent portfolio. But for Lenovo, the access it will get to the U.S. and Latin American smartphone markets is largely seen to be complementary to its existing global PC business. And the acquisition of Motorola is also in step with its recent decision to buy IBM's small mainframe server business for roughly $2.3 billion. For Motorola, the synergies of the deal are seen by many to be equally advantageous, including access to the vast Chinese market and a new parent company that is flush with ready cash. The transaction will have to be approved by U.S. and Chinese regulators. Bitcoin, presently the world's largest virtual currency, has many proponents, but also more than a few critics worried about the ease with which monies can be transferred nearly anonymously across borders using this virtual innovation. In some parts of the world, though, proponents and critics are attempting to come together to address possible criminal activity while protecting the innovation. On Monday of the past week, U.S. federal prosecutors announced arrests in the use of Bitcoin to allegedly sell over $1 million in illegal drugs. Richard Zabel, deputy U.S. attorney in New York, commented to National Public Radio that the fact that large amounts of Bitcoins can be transferred anonymously and safely to someone located anywhere in the world with just a click of a computer key has become attracted for arms dealers, drug traffickers, and money launderers. As noted in the NPR story by Ilya Meretz for Morning Edition, the value of Bitcoin has changed much over the past year, from a low of $13 to a high of $1,000. Some mainstream businesses, though, are starting to pick up on its benefits, including Overstock.com, which began accepting Bitcoin as a form of payment. And according to the NPR piece, since early January, customers have used Bitcoin to purchase about $600,000 in goods through Overstock. Their executive vice chairman, Jonathan Johnson, commented to NPR that this may be a small sum for a big retailer, but as with credit card payments, these usually take a few days to process. With Bitcoin, Overstock gets paid right away, and there's a lot to like about it. As Ben Losky, the New York State Superintendent of Financial Services, told NPR, they want to do something in New York in 2014, hopefully to make innovation happen, but also to root out money laundering. And if we get it right, he said, we can have business certainty, which might also help make New York a center for legitimate Bitcoin commerce. In late December, Scott Kohler of the Information Law Group did an excellent story outlining the many ways in which financial services firms have been reacting and moving in the wake of the Target data breach revealed in mid-December. The story, published on December 30th at www.infologroup.com, noted that within 2 days of the announced breach, J.P. Morgan had alerted nearly 2 million of its debit card holders that it was lowering the daily limit on ATM withdrawals to $100, and purchases would be capped at $300 per day. Despite the limitations coming in the midst of the holiday buying season, the moves were largely seen as protective of consumer and company interests, given that the Target breach reportedly compromised the credit and debit card information of an estimated 40 million customers. According to Mr. Kohler's piece, Citibank took a different approach, announcing that they would impose limits on blocked transactions if they noticed suspicious activity, while other banks have simply struggled with the decision whether to cancel and reissue customer cards. At roughly $3 to $5 per card, reissuing can be an expensive and time-consuming process, according to Mr. Kohler, especially when companies don't know which cards have been compromised. But one of the more interesting aspects of the story by Mr. Kohler was the move made by a New England bank, which was able to buy back stolen credit cards from a black market card shop. And by purchasing the cards online, the bank was able to confirm that the Target breach did not compromise the three-digit security codes of the cards, which would make the stolen numbers harder to use legitimately with online retailers. In a related story earlier this week, the U.S. Justice Department announced that it has begun its own investigation of the Target breach and its potential impacts. More on this aspect of the story likely in weeks to come. As we push into the first quarter of 2014, some both on and off Capitol Hill in the U.S. are seeing that the prospects for possible immigration reform may be looking up. In an excellent piece written as a blog by Emma Buckhout for the New Democrats Network, a think tank based in Washington, D.C., she outlined 6 reasons for being optimistic. One of these reasons cites that both sides are closer to a possible deal than they have been ever before, with not only passage of a Senate bill this past fall, but also a bill in the House that combined elements of the Senate Judiciary Committee text with a House border security bill, achieving a first glimmer of bipartisan support before the turn of the year. One of the key sticking points to consensus has been the issue of border security. Whereas early House drafts called for an expensive border surge and militarization of the border, Senator John McCain, along with colleague Senators Flake and Cornyn, have reportedly attempted to bring the conversation back to the real needs of the Department of Homeland Security and Customs and Border officials. As noted by Ms. Buckhout, the current framework begun by the Senate emphasizes the needs of national security through greater border control and interior enforcement, noting that Immigration and Customs Enforcement had issued a report in December showing a first annual yearly decrease in deportations, while increased numbers of criminal prosecutions. A second key stumbling block in recent negotiations has been the notion of creating a path to citizenship for some illegal immigrants. According to the piece, the current Senate framework does provide the potential for 11 million illegal immigrants to begin a path to citizenship, but if so, it would be a difficult one that does not reward those who came illegally, but requires back taxes, fines, English competency, and would preference non-illegal candidates for immigration in line for a naturalization process. With potential emphasis on growth and deficit reduction that an immigration reform package and the efficiencies it could bring if passed in 2014, this is a space that will be closely watched in the first half of this year. A top tech story from early 2013 has largely taken a back seat since NSA surveillance revelations began in June, and that is reform of the Electronic Communications Privacy Act, or ECPA, although it's never been completely out of the picture. As we reported back in May of last year, when the law was passed in 1986, there was no cloud, no iTunes, or YouTube, and the number of people using email was so few that they likely all could meet for coffee in your kitchen. By those standards, a key portion of the law, at that time and in that context, made sense. It said that if users keep email on a third-party server for more than 180 days, they've abandoned that information, and law enforcement need only a subpoena, not a court order, to look at it. Today, of course, Americans store years' worth of email and other communications online, write everything from work-related documents to love letters on cloud-based applications, and often use third-party servers to hold files, much as they would on a home hard drive. This isn't just metadata, but it's the full content of communications and whatever documents might be attached. Senator Patrick Leahy, Democrat of Vermont and chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee, has been working diligently for some time to update the law. His reforms would require law enforcement to at least obtain a search warrant to obtain the email content of any age from a third party, with certain exceptions. The Senate Judiciary Committee approved these and other changes to the package, passed in mid-2013, but the bill has yet to be scheduled for a vote before the full Senate. And the House has not put forward a companion bill with similar possibilities for movement. Into this gap, the Washington Post reported in August, several states have moved to take matters into their own hands, updating state law for the 21st century, where the aging ECPA had ceded the floor, although such state-level changes apply only to state law enforcement. Texas, according to the Post story, was the first to pass such a bill. In June of 2013, Governor Rick Perry signed into law HB 2268, increasing controls on when email retained for greater than 180 days can be accessed. In Montana, the Email and Location Tracking Privacy Bill, or HB 603, became law in the State House with virtually no opposition. And in Maine, lawmakers passed a measure requiring a warrant to access the content of text messages, and also override a governor's veto to require a warrant to track a cell phone or other electronic device. And in case you might think that calls for update to ECPA are only coming from a select number of activist state legislators, there is also the Digital Due Process Coalition, an advocacy group that has existed for several years with the express intent to promote update of the 28-year-old tech-related law. Among the privacy and rights-related members of the group are Microsoft, Oracle, AT&T, eBay, Facebook, IBM, and the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. On December 12, 2013, the Washington Post columnist Brian Fung reported that over 100,000 people had signed a We the People petition to President Obama supporting updating changes to ECPA. The petition read in part that while Americans are deeply concerned about surveillance issues, it's not the only problem. For those who listened to or read President Obama's State of the Union message last Tuesday, there were a few important notes on the tech sector. Noting that the administration has enabled Rolla, North Carolina, and Youngstown, Ohio as hubs for high-tech manufacturing, where businesses are connected to research universities to advance innovation. According to the president, the plan is to introduce 6 more of these hubs. And there was also a pledge in the speech to connect 99% of schools to high-speed broadband over the next 4 years, specifically calling out the FCC and companies like Apple, Microsoft, Sprint, and Verizon. The president noted that there is a down payment to connect 15,000 schools and 20 million students over the next 2 years, adding that to do so would not add to the deficit. Other than these two items, there was also a brief nod in the speech to the recommendations that the president made in his January 17th speech on NSA reforms at the U.S. Department of Justice, noting that the vital work of our intelligence community depends on public confidence both here and abroad. And that will be all for us this week. You have been listening to 40ANM in 5. For more information and for our terms of use, visit 40a-m.com. All stories for this week's download were reported by at least 2 online or print news sources, or taken directly from relevant releases, with the exception of specific reporting highlighted from the Washington Post, the BBC, the Information Law Group, National Public Radio, the New Democrats Network and blogger Emma Buckhout, and the European Voice. Thank you for listening. 40ANM in 5 will be off next week, but we will be back with you again on Monday, February 17th. Until then, make this week and every week one to remember. And bye for now. Thank you.